stop. Just tell me where they went.
I don't know, Fluke said through gritted teeth. I put them up in my barn because it was the right thing to do. I didn't know they'd left. I only woke when I heard the animals.
But you have an idea, don't you? Hart snarled. You Ossians stick together close as winter ravens. Tell us.
Step back, watchman, Clisson told him sternly, incensed at the interruption.
Hart ignored him. Tell us, you damned oaf, he shouted, and struck the kneeling man on the top of his head with the pommel of his sword. Fluke tumbled face down into the mud.
Hart!
Clisson shouted in outrage and disbelief.
He knows, you can see it,
Hart insisted, pulling Flake up by his hair. Blood and rainwater ran in rivulets down his face.
Where did they go? Where?
Fluke managed to shake his head mutely before Hart smashed the pommel of his sword down on the bridge of his nose, splintering it to mush.
Liar! He roared.
Don't know, don't know, don't...
Fluke mumbled, dazed with pain.
Liar!
Hart hit him again.
Filthy, subhuman, Ossian liar!
Clisson stared at Hart in shock. The situation was spiralling out of control. Hart had been recalcitrant before, but never outright disobedient. Now he was red-faced, grimacing, far past reason. Clisson looked for support from Captain Dressel, but he was in one of the outbuildings. There was only Plague, and Clisson wouldn't ask for help from him.
"Stop this now,"
he said, conscious of Lord Jadral cringing behind him. His command fell on deaf ears.
"Tell us,"
Hart screamed, pulling Fluke to his feet.
"Tell us where they've gone."
But Fluke was beyond listening. Overwhelmed by horror, pain, and the imaginary disease still eating at him, he staggered towards the farmhouse, gargling and pawing at his face.
"Where are you going, bumpkin?"
Hart sneered. Then he grabbed Fluke's hair again and ran him through with his sword. Fluke went stiff, his head tipped back in Hart's grip. He coughed once, blood flooding over his lips, then slid from the blade and fell to the ground in a heap. Hart turned to Clisson, panting, a savage, joyous challenge in his eyes. The same look he'd worn when he slew the prisoner back in Shoal Point. A look of triumph, as if to say, "That's how it's done." Clisson stepped forward, pulled off a glove, and delivered a stinging slap across his face, hard enough to send his hat flying. Hart gaped at him, stunned.
"You are no watchman, but a common butcher," Clisson barked. "An embarrassment to our uniform. We are the Emperor's representatives in this land, and if that man was a traitor, we would have shown it by procedure and due authority. Rest assured, I will be reporting your many infractions in Morgenholm, and with the stain I will put on your record, you will be lucky if you ever make watchman first class, let alone overwatchman. Any further insubordination, and I'll ensure you spend the rest of your days rotting at a desk in the most remote backwater of Ozak I can find. Are we understood?"
Clisson was shaking by the time he finished. He couldn't remember ever being so angry before. He wouldn't have thought himself capable. But he saw now what Hart was. Spy or no, he was a bully who enjoyed killing far too much. Clisson hated bullies. He'd had enough of that in his youth, and he wouldn't permit the reputation of the Iron Hand to be sullied by an overprivileged upstart who thought that pinning the double cross to his shoulder meant he could murder with impunity. Captain Dressel was hurrying over now, having become aware of their confrontation. Clisson held Hart's gaze long enough to see surprise turn to humiliation and outright loathing. Then he turned to Dressel. "Anyone else?" he asked, as if nothing had happened.
"Only farmhands," said Dressel, eyeing the scene.
"Might I suggest something?"
said Lord Jadral meekly, raising a finger. He looked somewhat nauseous at the sight of Fluke.
"His brother, Keel, his cottage is not far from here, along that track to the west. Perhaps that is where they went."
"Very well," said Clisson. "Go back to the town with all haste and raise the garrison. The fugitives have no horses, so they may try to escape by the docks. Hart, go with him. Dressel,
Gather the iron guard. We will head to the cottage.
Yes, overwatchman, said Dressel.
Clisson clapped his hands at Jadrell.
All haste, my lord, we are losing time.
Jadrell jumped and scampered off towards his horse. Dressel began calling for his troops to form up. Before he walked away, Clisson reserved a final glare of scorn for Hart, whose blonde hair was plastered flat, face set in an expression of pure hate. Back in your place, rat, Clisson thought with righteous fury, and this time you'll stay there. 61. Keel's eyes flew open at the sound of a fist pounding on the door of his cottage. He lurched out of bed, stumbled into his trousers while reaching for the sword propped up in the corner. Haste made him clumsy. His foot snagged. He hopped a step and then crashed to the floor.
Who's there? Who's knocking at this hour?
Mariella was bolt upright in bed, her face a picture of fright as thunder tumbled overhead.
It's them, thought Keel.
He'd been waiting for a knock at the door ever since he took up arms against the Crodans. Dying in combat had never scared him. What scared him was the quiet efficiency of men in dark coats who turned up late at night and spirited their victims away to unguessable torments.
"Keel, who is it?"
Mariella cried again. He felt a flare of anger as he struggled to pull on the rest of his clothes.
"Stop bothering me with stupid questions."
If he faced them, he'd face them dressed and armed and—
"Keel, I'm going to see,"
he shouted, fear making him furious. She cringed against the headboard, shocked. Keel instantly regretted his tone, hated himself for scaring her.
"I'm going, eh?"
he said, more gently, and left before she could marshal her own anger and shout back. He hurried past Tad's door, it was mercifully quiet inside, and down the stairs into the kitchen. As he neared, he heard a voice he knew on the other side, and the tension in his belly loosened a little.
"Keel! Open up!"
Not the Iron Hand, but Garrick. Keel pulled the latch and opened the door, sword in hand. Garrick was grim-faced beneath his soaking hood. The others gathered in the dark beyond, hunched and nervous.
"They found us," Keel said flatly. "They found us," Garrick agreed. "We have to go."
"I can't."
The words came without thought. He wasn't ready. He was supposed to have one more night with his wife. He didn't have to decide until tomorrow.
Garrick had no time to be gentle. "What do you think they'll do if they catch you here? What'll they do to Mariella and Tad to make you talk? Best thing you can do for them is leave. They can't use them against you if they can't find you."
Keel fought for an answer, unable to accept this moment had come. There had to be another way. He heard Mariella on the landing, drawn down the stairs by their voices, and felt trapped. A flicker of lightning lit the sodden yard and bracken-thick hill beyond. He saw the Skarl, tall Harrod, standing protectively by Orica, the two boys, Fenn and Vika and Ruck too, but not his brother.
"Is Fluke with you?" he asked. "He's still at the farm," said Garrick. "You left him there?"
Keel was aghast.
"Should I have told him we were escaping? We'd be dead if Vika hadn't warned us. For all I know, he was the one who sold us out."
"He'd never do that,"
cried Mariella as she reached the bottom of the stairs, hair in a tangle and her face screwed up in rage.
"Now you've brought the Crodans down on our heads, get out of our lives."
Garrick gave her a look of disdain that made Keel angry on her behalf. They'd disliked each other from the start, which was why Keel endeavoured never to bring them together.
"You're only part of this if you make yourself part of it," Garrick told her. "You don't want that. We'll lead them away. They likely won't come here at all if they can chase us."
"We are part of this. He's my husband and he's staying to look after our son."
"I'll answer for myself, Mariella,"
Keel snapped, moved to sharpness by stung pride. He wouldn't have the others think his decisions were made by his wife.
"I wish you would," she snapped. "Stay or go. Too long you've had the best of both."
"We could find somewhere to hide," Keel told Garrick. "My family and I. My uncle's house is half a day from here.
We can stay with him till the Iron Hand leave Rackon Bay.
In this storm, Mariella said, Tad can barely get out of bed. The journey would kill him.
Garrick ignored her. Everyone in Rackon Bay will know you're a wanted man after tonight. Even if you lay low, you'll be arrested the moment you emerge. What's done is done, and I'm sorry for it, but you can't stay here and you can't come back to Rackon Bay. Ever.
Keel felt like the walls were closing in on him. Mariella was right. He'd procrastinated too long, unwilling to give up the freedom of the road, but afraid to lose his family. Now the choice was out of his hands, and what he wanted didn't matter any more.
"This is my home," he said weakly.
"Aye, but no longer," said Garrick. "You don't like that? Fight with us. The only way you'll get it back is if the Crodans are driven from our land."
Garrick saw him waver and pressed his argument.
"We need you, Keel. The boats are the only way out, and none of us can steer a course through a storm such as this. None but you."
Keel looked over his shoulder at his wife, who was still poised at the foot of the stairs.
"I meant what I said," she told him. "If you leave, you're dead to us."
"Would you have me stay and die anyway?" he asked. "Garrick's right. They'll torture you just to punish me. They'll take this place from us."
"You didn't do anything," she argued. "They can't do anything without proof."
Garrick snorted.
"They've never needed proof in the past."
"Get out of my house, you bastard," Mariella screamed. "I rue the day you ever came to this town. Would that you'd drunk yourself to death like you wanted instead of taking my husband from me."
A rising wail sounded behind her, an insensible blare of distress coming from upstairs.
"Now see what you've done," Mariella said, tears of frustration welling. "Keel, shut the door. I don't care if you're on this side of it or that, but make up your mind."
Keel held her gaze, pleading, desperate. He couldn't find the words, but his eyes said it for him. Her face fell. Even at the last, she hadn't truly believed he'd leave. Now she knew better.
"Farewell then, husband," she said,
her voice cracking. Then she fled up the stairs. He was still staring after her when Vika pushed past Garrick and thrust a flask into his hand.
"A small amount of that in boiled water each day," she told him. "Have Tad breathe the vapours. Go and tell her."
"Leave it on the table," Garrick snapped, a hand on his arm. "You need to come with us now."
His touch ignited something in Keel, a burning fury lashing out in search of a target. It was Garrick's fault it had come to this, Garrick who'd led him astray. He pulled away violently. He wouldn't let it end like this.
"Mariella!"
he cried, and ran up the stairs, Garrick shouting after him. He caught her at the top of the stairs, on the narrow landing, with her hand on the door to Tad's room. Tad was screaming in there, upset by the raised voices. She turned to him with pathetic hope in her eyes.
"You'll stay," she breathed.
The hope died as she saw the flask in his hand.
"A little in boiled water, once a day. He should breathe the steam," he said.
"I told you, Keel," she said. "If you want him to take that quack medicine, stay here and deliver it yourself. Be a father."
He fought for the right words.
"Don't let me go like this, Mariella. I'll be back. I'll find the money for Tad, I swear, but I need to know you..."
"Love you?"
Her face had gone hard. He'd caused her too much pain too many times. There was no more kindness in her.
"No, Keel. You just want me to make you feel better about abandoning us, but I won't. I hope it kills you every day."
Her cruelty shocked him, so much that he refused to believe she meant it.
"Go and see old Ganny. Get him to write to me."
"I'm not going to see Ganny. Write to me.
Send it to the Burned Bear in Morganholm. Let me know you and Tad are well, that Fluke is well."
Her face was immobile. Only the tears in her eyes showed her suffering.
"I won't," she said, "and I'll burn any letter from you before anyone can read it to me."
That took his breath away, and he couldn't look at her after that. He reached for the door instead, to go past her into Tad's bedroom, desperate to hold him and stop the screaming if he could.
She put her hand on his chest, without force, but stopping him as surely as any wall.
"How will you help? Will you tell him you're going away again?"
she asked. Her voice was iron calm now.
"You can't make it better. Let him forget you. Let me."
She stepped inside the bedroom and shut the door behind her, leaving Kiel on the landing alone, rejected, laid waste. He listened to Mariella soothing their son, and knew that he'd lost her at last, lost them both forever. He was on one side of the door, and his family were on the other, separated by a few inches of wood, and an impassable gulf of hurt. He put the flask on the floor and walked away. 62. The rain splattered and swirled along the gutters of Rackham Bay, crawling down walls, racing between cobblestones. The town had taken shelter, retreating inside, and the narrow grey lanes were ghostly with shifting light and wet whispers. Silent as ghosts themselves, hidden by heavy cloaks, the fugitives went unseen. Aaron checked over his shoulder for the dozenth time, afraid of what followed. "Dreadnights," Vika said. He remembered how they'd killed four of Garrick's band the first time they met, the horrific efficiency of that slaughter, like a grinder chewing meat. They were no mere men, but a force implacable as time. They could be delayed, but not stopped. Cade hustled along at his side. He caught a glimpse of his friend's face, pallid with suppressed terror, and gave him a brave smile that convinced neither of them. In a few hours, they'd have been on a ship to Morgenholm, safe from pursuit. Surely not even Dreadnights would be able to find them in the mazy capital. But the enemy had caught up with them faster than they'd believed possible, and though nobody said so, they all knew why. If only they'd kept their heads down and stayed out of the fight at the Reaver's Rest, they'd have passed unnoticed. But Aaron had got them involved, and now they might all end up paying for it. Beyond the tall, tight-packed buildings of Rackham Bay was the harbour. Warehouses, jetties, and a shipyard cluttered the shore. Boats at anchor rocked on the restless waves, protected from the worst of the storm by the breakwater. Further out, the cut was churning, crashing up against the foot of the Ghoul Fort. Garrick found shelter at the corner of a shuttered bakery and looked out towards the docks. Aaron took station across the street. At first he saw only curtains of rain and flapping tarpaulin stirring on empty boats. Then lightning blasted the scene, showing him Croden soldiers moving along the waterfront. Garrick swore.
"The squareheads second-guessed us."
He strained to see in the dark.
"Docks are sewn up tight. We won't get out that way."
Thunder boomed overhead, crackling away into the distance.
"Head for the woods?" Aaron suggested.
"Dreadnights don't tire. Even with Vika's aid, they'd run us down on foot."
Then his face cleared, and a decision was made.
"There's another way," he said.
A shout of alarm made them whirl. A Croden soldier emerging from a street to their left. Fenn put an arrow in his chest before he could draw breath, but it was too late. Already his fellows were running up behind him. Garrick's sword sang free of its sheath and he sprang forward, Kiel and Harrod with him. They met the soldiers at the mouth of the street in a clatter of steel, water spraying from their blades as they darted and swung. The soldiers were twice their number and more, but they found themselves matched by the three men that opposed them. Harrod held the centre, stiff and disciplined, his blade flicking here and there while his body barely moved. To either side, Kiel and Garrick fought savagely. Kiel was formidable, but Garrick married brute force with technique and was by far the superior of the two. Aaron drew his own sword uncertainly, trying to gather enough courage to join them. Before he could, Cade drew his attention. Four more soldiers were approaching down the stepped, sloping alley behind them. His guts pulled tight. Kiel, Harrod, and Garrick were occupied with the first patrol. There was no one to defend them from these newcomers. Fenn swung around and loosed a hasty shot, which thudded into the pelvis of the foremost guard, sending him tumbling with a scream. The rest kept coming, and Aaron ran towards them, because it was that or wait to die. A soldier loomed before him. Their swords crashed together. The other two rushed past to either side, seeking other targets. Aaron parried desperately, fending off the Croden's hacking strokes. There was no stopping and no surrender. He didn't really know how to fight, so he was going to die. The terrifying finality of that swamped him, and in a moment of panic, he let his guard down. The Croden knocked his sword aside and plunged in for the killing thrust. Aaron reacted on instinct and did what he'd done 1,000 times before under Master Oryk's tutelage. He stepped aside, knocked the blade down with his sword, and swept it back up at his opponent's head. He should have hit the soldier's throat, but he was clumsy and the tip of his sword caromed off the soldier's cheek guard, hard enough to ring his head like a bell. The soldier staggered back. For a heartbeat, they stared at each other in surprise. Realization sunk in. He'd been trained for this. All those years of the sword with Master Oryk, feinting and parrying and watching his footwork, had been for this moment, so that when it came to it, he could move faster than he could think, react without question. "I can fight," he told himself. And he did. Their blades met again and again. Aaron was no longer on the back foot, but he fought carefully and defensively. With every block, his confidence grew. Every time he pushed his enemy back, he felt stronger. Panting breath, clenched teeth, sword on sword. His arm was starting to ache, but it didn't matter. They'd only fought for seconds, but it seemed like an eternity. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw one of the soldiers scream and arch his back as Grubb drove a knife into his spine. He saw Orica hiding in a doorway, heard Fenn's bow again. More soldiers were coming from somewhere. He couldn't see Cade and didn't have time to look for him. "To overcome your enemy, you must first understand him," Master Oryk's favourite maxim. It brought clarity out of chaos and sharpened his mind. For the first time, he saw beyond the armour to the man he was fighting, a young man hardly older than he was, with doubt in his eyes. Suddenly, he knew this Croden, this boy trying to be a man, an unwilling soldier pushed into the life of the sword. He knew as little of real combat as Aaron did, less, in fact. This was his first fight with death on the line. He'd never killed anyone. Uniform or no, Aaron had been blooded where his opponent hadn't. "I'm better than him," Aaron thought in amazement, and with that he attacked. A quick feint. The soldier lurched to defend against it. Aaron went the other way, under his guard, and struck a glancing blow to his ribs, cutting between the plates of his armour into the leather and flesh beneath. The soldier screamed in pain, his guard collapsing as he stumbled back. Aaron swung hard and chopped through the forearm of his offhand. His scream became a breathless wail as he dropped his sword and clutched the stump of his arm, then tumbled onto his arse on the rainy cobbles. "Run him through," said Master Oryk in his head. But his opponent was out of the fight, white with shock, and Aaron didn't have the stomach to slay a helpless man. He stepped back, chest heaving.
"Vika!"
It was Cade's voice. Aaron whirled to see the druidess backing up as a burly soldier advanced on her. Harrod had broken away from his fight and was standing with Orica. Cade had wisely stuck close to him, sheltering behind Harrod's blade rather than Aaron's. There were more soldiers lying dead, pierced by Fenn's arrows, and Grubb had a man on the ground with his head pulled back, sawing at his throat with goblin glee as blood gushed out onto the cobbles. Aaron ran to help Vika, but Ruck got there first, racing out of the rain to sink her teeth into the soldier's calf. The soldier roared and tried to stab the hound, but Vika stepped forward then, dashing a handful of powder in his face. His roars became shrieks as he pawed at his eyes, Ruck still savaging his leg. By the time Aaron reached him, his face was blistered and burned, tear-streaked and smoking in the rain. Aaron gritted his teeth and drove his sword through the man's belly, up into his heart. He gargled, shuddered, and went slack. After that, there was no one left to fight. Aaron looked this way and that, and saw only dead and wounded Crodans. The soldier who'd lost an arm had fallen silent, lying on his side, the stump drawn up against his chest. He was probably going to bleed out and die. Aaron found he didn't care. The brutality of battle had numbed him to sympathy and grief. Survival was the only goal. Garrick and Keel came striding over. Harrod was breathlessly apologizing to Orica for not being there earlier. Between them, they'd killed 9.
"There's more coming up from the docks," Garrick told them. "Keep moving."
"Where to?" asked Aaron.
"Jadril's got a launch in his boathouse, small enough for us to sail."
He surveyed the junction, the dead there. Then he gave Aaron a rough slap on the arm.
"You fought well," he said.
Aaron felt a flush of pride at his words, and a grateful smile jumped onto his face. Then he remembered who he was talking to, and wiped it off, angry at himself.
"You do not know whether to hate or admire him," Vika had said. "But couldn't he do both?"
Through thunder and storm they ran. A horn sounded behind them, and they hid as a Crodan patrol hurried past in the next street. The whole garrison was on the alert now. They went up sloping lanes and stairs running with water as they climbed towards Lord Jadral's mansion. Soon they saw it, perched on a cliff overlooking the cut. Next to it was the boathouse, a stout timber construction with a thick door that opened onto the street. The door was securely padlocked.
"Out of the way. Grab good with locks."
The skull produced 2 thin slivers of metal, one with a hooked end, and got to work. The others took up positions watching the approaches. From where they stood, they had a good view of the way they'd come. The rain-swept thoroughfare ran downhill towards the heart of the town, crossed by 6 others. Some way down the hill, a patrol emerged onto the street. One of the men saw them and shouted. In moments, they were joined by a larger group, and 20 or 30 soldiers swarmed towards them.
"Skull, make it fast," Garrick said.
"Hollow man not helping Grubb's concentration," Grubb muttered.
This time, when Keel, Garrick, and Harrod formed a defensive line, Aaron went with them, his blade ready. The numbers against them were greater, the street wider, their chances slim. But Aaron would fight nonetheless, without thought of retreat. Let them come. He saw a figure on horseback riding up behind the troops, and a thrill of recognition ran through him. Though he was some way off, he knew the man by his dress and his posture. He didn't need to see beneath the broad-brimmed hat to identify the man who'd killed his father. Hart. A red rage swarmed behind his eyes, and he was seized by the urge to charge, to hack through the enemy so he could wrap his hands around that throat. But this was no bard's tale, and he was no hero. If he was to take revenge on his father's murderer, it wouldn't be today, not with so many standing in his way. There was a click from behind him, and a clanking of chain.
"Grab done it!"
Garrick turned away from the oncoming troops, wrenched the heavy door open.
"In! In!"
he shouted, ushering the others past him.
"Thank you, Grubb. Good job, Grubb,"
the skull grumbled resentfully as he went inside. But Aaron didn't move. He was still looking down the street.
"Let him see me," he thought. "Let him know I'm coming for him."
As if he'd heard, Hart raised his head, and their eyes met across the distance. Aaron's hot hate against the watchman's cool arrogance.
"Aaron!"
Cade tugged at him, but Aaron wouldn't break that gaze, not until he heard hooves clattering and 3 terrible figures rode into view in front of the troops.
Dreadknights.
"Inside, now!"
Garrick snarled, yanking him out of the rain and into the boathouse, where Grubb bolted and padlocked the door behind them. The space inside was dominated by Jadral's launch, a long rowing boat with raised covered decks to fore and aft. It rested on struts a few feet off the floor, suspended from the ceiling by a cradle of ropes and pulleys. It was brightly painted in the green and yellow of Jadral's house, and there was a crest at the bow with leaping fish, prowling wolves, and castles displaying his family's heritage and their connections to other notable powers. It was a Crodan affectation that made Garrick sneer when he saw it.
"Aaron, Cade, get the gates open. Keel and I will see to the boat."
Keel was already working the winch that operated the overhead pulleys, tightening the ropes until they took the vessel's weight. The others set to pulling the struts aside to allow Keel to lower it onto the slipway. Aaron and Cade ran to the end of the boathouse, where they unlatched the wooden gates and shoved them open. The wind howled in and around them, and they found themselves overlooking the torrid grey-blue waters of the cut. Cade leaned out and peered down the slipway.
"Don't reckon this is entirely safe," he opined.
"Am I hearing you right?" Aaron shouted over the wind. "Is this the same Cade that faced a savage she-warg and lived to tell the tale?"
"It was a wild pig," Cade pointed out. "It was a big wild pig," Aaron replied.
Cade laughed, and for a moment it felt like they were boys again, back in Shoal Point, and adventures still ended at dinner time. Then something huge and heavy crashed against the door to the street, and Grubb jumped back as the chain rattled wildly through the handles.
"Grubb think it's time to go," he said.
"Get in the boat,"
Garrick barked at them.
"Harrod, Grubb, Keel, help me push."
"Why Grubb always have to do the hard work?"
"Now!"
Keel had lowered the boat onto the slipway and was hacking away the ropes that held it, while the others clambered in and Ruck was hoisted up. Garrick sliced through the anchor rope, which was meant to ease the boat slowly down to the water. They wouldn't be going slowly this time. A second blow hit the door, and the head of Ruin's hammer smashed through it, almost taking it off its hinges. The Dreadknight wrenched the hammer free, and Aaron glimpsed plague and sorrow behind him.
"Push!"
Garrick roared, and they put their shoulders to the boat. It slid forward easily on greased rollers, and Aaron felt the nauseating anticipation of the drop at the end as the boat gathered speed. Once the momentum was too great to stop, the four men who were pushing began to scramble into the moving boat. Grubb was nimble enough to climb over the side without aid, and Keel had little trouble either, but Harrod was wearing splint mail and needed help. Garrick got his arms over the gunwale, and Aaron and Cade, who were nearest, reached over and started pulling him in. The door burst apart in a blast of spinning timber as Ruin charged into the boathouse. Plague and Shadow darted in behind him. The boat, accelerating fast, jolted against a jammed roller. Harrod fell into the boat, crushing Fenn and Orica against the side. Cade stumbled, lost his grip on Garrick, and tripped over a rowing bench. Suddenly, Garrick was sliding back over the side of the boat, feet trailing on the ground. Aaron, who had one of his arms, lunged forwards to grab the other. The muscles of his back wrenched as they took the strain. The boat had almost reached the boathouse gates. Ruin thundered after the escaping fugitives, clanking and thumping as he ran alongside the slipway. Plague raised his bow and drew. Garrick was trying to find his feet, tripping along beside the boat as it pulled away from him. Only Aaron's grip kept him from falling behind. He looked into the eyes of the hollow man, the man who'd sworn to kill his father and who, in a way, had done so. After all, the Crodans only killed Randall to get to Garrick. All Aaron had to do was let him go, and the Dreadknights would have their prize. It would all be over, and Cade would be safe. Without Garrick, the rest of them were insignificant, not worth the chase. In a moment of wild temptation, he thought he might do it. But it was a moment only, and it passed. He planted his feet against the side of the boat and hauled with all his might. Garrick found his footing and launched himself upwards, and then Keel was there, grabbing Garrick by his belt, adding his strength to Aaron's. They all tumbled into the boat in a heap. Somewhere among the knocks and bruises and the tangle of limbs, Aaron heard the snap of a bowstring. Vika grunted, folded up, fell back against the gunwale. Then the world began to tip.
"Grab something!"
Keel yelled.
Gravity took hold, and the boat slithered into a headlong plunge to the terrifying tempo of the slipway's wooden ribs clacking past faster and faster. Fenn screamed as they plummeted towards the waves, her voice drowned out by the wind. They braced as best they could, but it was never going to be enough. As they crashed into the water, they were flung violently forward. Aaron slammed against something wooden and painfully solid. He saw Cade go skidding past him, his head caroming off a supply chest, leaving him in a limp heap, unconscious or worse. Aaron tried to get to him, but was blinded by a wash of salty water which exploded over the bow, stinging his face and soaking him. Suddenly, the boat was turning wildly, black rocks looming above it.
"Get to the oars!" Keel bellowed.
Then he went scrambling towards the stern, stepping over Vika, who lay in a heap of hides and tangled trinkets. Aaron, too disorientated to think for himself, did as he was ordered. Others clambered onto the benches around him and fumbled oars into place. Garrick yelled,
"Pull!"
And they did, clumsily at first, but tightening the rhythm with each stroke. Orica was to Aaron's right, her hair a wet draggle, arms straining. Fenn worked ahead of him. Grubb's biceps bulged as he applied himself to his task, with the determination of the desperate. Waves surged over the side, swilling round their feet and the sliding, rolling bodies of Cade and Vika. Ruck barked in a frenzy, skidding about as she tried to summon help for her fallen mistress. Lightning flashed, thunder boomed, and the wind screamed. The horizon tilted and tipped until Aaron had no idea which direction they were going. He could hardly see through the tempest. He wanted to go to Cade but didn't dare let go of the oar. From out of the chaos came laughter. It was Keel, hauling on the tiller atop the stern deck, skin glistening and his head thrown back.
"Come then, Joha!" he screamed, madness in his voice. "I dare you! Crush us if you can!"
"Pull!" Garrick shouted, and they did, hauling their way another few feet through the waves. The boat yawed and bucked. Aaron's arms and back ached, and his hands sang with pain.
"Pull!"
Again they drew on their oars, and again, until it was all Aaron knew. The agony of effort became a background haze. He was taken by the same mulish trance that had got him through endless hours chipping stone in the mine. Only Garrick's voice mattered. Only the next pull, and the next.
"Hold!"
The break in the rhythm brought Aaron back to himself. He blinked and looked about. They were out on the channel now, far from either shore, and though waves still tipped and crashed over the boat, there were no rocks to dash against. Rakan Bay was a distant cluster of lights through the rain, and they were speeding westwards, carried along the coast by a fast current. Freed from the oar, Aaron staggered unsteadily across the boat to Cade. He hauled his friend from the water and sat him up against the chest. Cade had a darkening bruise on the side of his head, but he half-wakened at Aaron's urging, and though groggy, he could focus his eyes with effort. Aaron was relieved. He'd taken a knock, but Cade was hard-headed.
"You'll be all right," he said, more to reassure himself than Cade. "You'll be all right."
Vika wasn't faring so well. The others had propped her up against the gunwale, her face a streaked mess of black and white paint, her eyes closed, and her hair in soggy ropes. A black-feathered arrow was buried deep in her shoulder.
"Will she live?" Orica asked.
"How would I know?" Garrick snapped. "She's the one with the healing arts."
He put his hand to his forehead in evident distress.
"Let's make her comfortable at least."
Ruck barked wildly as they set about it, out of her mind with anxiety. Aaron looked back to the tiller, where Keel had fallen silent. His gaze was distant, turned towards the lights of the town, his expression a bleak mix of shocked grief and emptiness. His wife, Aaron thought. His son. The boat sailed on through dark and the tempest, heading for the sea.
63. "Which of you has the answer? Come on, speak up."
Mara waited before the blackboard,
sweeping the room expectantly with hard eyes. She was lean, with short hair the colour of brushed steel, and a sharp-featured face, creased with the wrinkles and folds of 50 years. Some of her pupils stared furiously past her, avoiding her gaze, trying to make sense of the sums and diagrams. The others looked down, hoping someone else would declare a solution so they wouldn't have to. There were 9 girls in the class, aged between 12 and 16, some from wealth and some from nothing, but all of them fabulously bright. She'd given them uniforms in the hope of erasing their differences, but they came through anyway. The rich ones arrived immaculate, dresses pressed and hair neat. The canal girls had dirt on their hems and brought runny noses and lice. "You all know how to do this," she told them. She pointed to a simple diagram representing an open-topped barrel sitting inside a larger vat. "You have some of the proportions of the 2 chambers, and you know how much water is being poured into the barrel. Work out how much you can fill the barrel before it overflows. Then you can work out how high the water will rise in the vat. If you do it step by step, it's quite straightforward." It wasn't straightforward. It was difficult, and that was the point. She'd left out vital information to hamper them, and it was easy to forget the barrel's displacing effect when calculating how much had overflowed. She hadn't told them how to account for that, so they'd have to stretch themselves to succeed, to reach into the unknown a little. In her lessons, as in life, they'd often find themselves dealt a hand that was less than fair. She'd teach them to overcome a disadvantage any way they could. The silence of urgent thought filled the classroom. Outside the sun was shining, but inside it was cool. The walls were panelled with heavy dark wood, and the air smelled of libraries and learning. Mara watched her charges and fought down a familiar frustration. Making them understand was the easy part. Getting them to raise their voices was the real battle. She wanted them to be reckless, to theorise wildly, to guess at what they didn't know. Mostly, they only answered when they were certain they wouldn't risk disapproval. Catalina had been with her 3 years and still didn't dare to be wrong. Jinnah flung up a hand. Keen little Jinnah was always the first to puzzle things out. Mara looked past her to Vanya, the youngest, sitting quietly with her tangled brown hair half hiding her face. "Vanya," she said.
"I don't know," Vanya said.
"Yes, you do. Try." She did try, and she figured it out in the end, but it took some time, and Mara had to walk her through it. Jinnah kept her hand up throughout. With every new hesitation, each mistake and misstep that Vanya made, Mara saw Jinnah becoming more impatient. She had the solution. She couldn't understand why no one wanted to listen to her. "Get used to it. There's a lot more of that ahead of you." When their lessons were over, the girls made their way out of the classroom, laughing and chattering. Jinnah still wore a scowl, but she said nothing as she passed Mara, who was sitting at her desk reading some paperwork. Mara would rather she complain than suffer in silence, but she could only expect so much. A lifetime of submission and low expectations could not be quickly undone. "Vanya, stay behind a moment." Vanya froze, her eyes full of terror. She was a gawky and gangly 12-year-old, caught up in the first rush of adolescent growth, and she walked with the manner of someone expecting a beating. "Don't be alarmed, child, it's nothing bad." That scarcely seemed to reassure her. She glanced enviously at the others as they left. They gave her sympathetic looks, and began to speculate about her detainment as soon as they were out of sight. Mara waited until the clamour of footsteps on the stairs had receded, then beckoned Vanya to stand before her. "It's come to my attention that your father has been unable to find work for some weeks." Vanya looked at her feet and nodded uncertainly.
"He's a builder, mistress. All the new buildings, they want them Croydon style. My dad don't know how to do that."
"Doesn't know," Mara corrected automatically.
"Doesn't know," repeated Vanya.
Mara produced a folded letter, sealed with her mark, and held it out. "Take this to Marun, the butcher, at the shackle market. He'll give you meat and groceries for your family. I won't have one of my pupils coming to class too hungry to work." Vanya took it, bewildered.
"Thank you, mistress," she said.
Mara returned her attention to the papers on her desk. Vanya belatedly realized she'd been dismissed and slipped away. Her paperwork done, Mara straightened the desks and set the classroom in order, then left and locked it behind her. The room was a hired space in a building otherwise filled with clerks' offices, a printmaker's, and an artist's studio on the top floor. The setting was conveniently central, near enough to the canals that the poorer girls could get there on foot, far enough away that the wealthy families wouldn't balk at sending their children there. She taught here 9 days a week. Jaws Day and Festen Day were rest days. She had little to thank the Crodans for, but she did admire their work ethic, and the Croden week, 5 days' work, one of rest, four of work, one of rest and worship, appealed to her more than the old Ossian week of 4-2-3-2, which had always struck her as excessively lax. Outside in the street, the noise and bustle of Morgenholm were waiting for her. Carts creaked by, and birds fluttered among the gabled roofs of South Heights. A pie-seller had parked his cart on the corner, hawking his wares to passers-by. A group of laughing Croden men emerged from their lunch at the beer hall down the road. Two finely dressed ladies browsed a confectioner's window, shading themselves from the afternoon sun with parasols. Clea was waiting with the carriage on the other side of the cobbled street, hunched in the driver's seat. Mara looked for a gap in the traffic, but before she could cross, she was hailed by a man nearby.
"Your pardon, be you Mara of Witherwall?"
She regarded him with immediate suspicion. He was a man of low means, ragged at the edges and smudged with dirt, though he'd evidently done his best to smarten himself up. That, and his deferential tone, told her he wanted something. Her eyes went to the young boy at his side, waifish and wide-eyed.
"I am," she said stiffly.
Over the road, Clea sat up, alert and ready to intervene.
"Your pardon, your pardon. They say you've a school, that you teach children, rich or poor, and you don't ask no coin for it. But you only teach them's what they call exceptional. My boy Lud, he..."
She held up a hand, interrupting him.
"I think you've been misinformed."
The man looked confused.
"You don't teach no school?"
"I don't teach boys."
A desperate look passed across the man's face.
"But Lud here, he's gifted. Speaks 4 languages and he ain't yet 11. Reads better than anyone. Ask him anything and he'll recall it clear as if it were a moment ago."
"Well, good. With such talent, no doubt he'll rise above the circumstances of his birth," she told him. "At worst, he'll find work as a translator, but likely he'll do better than that. Many masters would be glad to take on such a prodigy, and he may even find his way to the Glass University."
She couldn't help the harsh tone that crept into her voice as she went on.
"Meanwhile, fully 1/2 of the population will never go to the Glass University, never be schooled to their potential, never be allowed a job with any status outside of a narrow few allowed them because they are seen as suitable to their nature. Your son, Ossian and low-born though he be, has the world at his feet by comparison, and there is a long line of children more disadvantaged who will pass through my doors before he will."
The man stared at her, confused. He was dimly aware that he'd been told off, but he wasn't sure why. She'd never had the knack of talking to uneducated folk.
"I wish you good fortune," she said. Then, without looking at the boy again, she crossed the street.
"All well?" Clea asked, eyeing the man and his child, hand near her sword. It crossed Mara's mind that she needed to renew the permit soon, just another thing to add to the calendar she kept in her head.
"Peace, Clea. He's no threat."
She watched the man walk away dejectedly, his hand on the boy's shoulder. The sight made her sad for a moment, and she wondered if she'd been too hasty.
but she brushed the thought away. Sympathy was a fine commodity in a world such as this. "I will take a walk, I think," she told Clear. "Meet me by the Arcalid at 12th bell a day. The time until then is yours." Clear didn't have a face made for gratitude. She smiled little and always looked serious. Mara liked that about her. It was a fine autumn day. The sun was pleasantly warm, and the sisters were waxing in the west. Lyssa was a pale pastel marble, made paler by the bright blue sky. Tantera loomed ghostly and glowering. Mara strode briskly. She did everything briskly, the heels of her shoes clicking on the cobbles as she headed through the streets of South Heights. Her mind was busy, thinking over tomorrow's lessons, plotting the best route to her destination, worrying about what she'd say when she got there. As she walked, she observed how the shadows thrown by chimneys onto rooftops became distorted by the angle of the sun, and wondered how to turn shadow casting into an experiment for her pupils. A fat pigeon scudded past, and she decided to obtain one to learn how such a bulky bird flew. A man sneezed nearby, and Mara wondered why sneezing made her feel so good afterwards, and if that feeling could be replicated chemically without the inconvenience of spraying mucus everywhere. Her mind turned and turned, never quiet. Even in sleep, which she needed little of, she dreamed vividly and often woke determined to investigate something she'd imagined while unconscious. Long ago, she'd come to realize that not everybody was like her, that the minds of most were not full of restless curiosity and calculation, but rather with bovine meanderings interspersed with lengthy periods of vacancy. She pitied and envied them at the same time. There were moments when she thought it might be a relief to be so benighted, to be free of the frustrations and cares of intellect, but she might as well have wished she were a cat. The traffic thickened as she approached the bridge, and she was forced to the side of the street by carts and carriages. At the mouth of the Promise Bridge, the denizens of the canal district swarmed up from below. They were poorer folk than the occupants of South Heights, living in the rank alleys at the foot of the hill. There, streets of tumble-down houses were mazed with narrow waterways that flooded whenever the river burst its banks, and rats were as numerous as flies. Mara joined the crowd, threading through the crush towards the bridge. Merchants in finery mixed with toothless hags and bookkeepers walked with sewermen. She looked around and wondered if there was a similarity between the way crowds moved and the way swarms of insects did. Finally, the bridge came into sight. Broad, long, and high, it stood on great pillared arches of stone that strode down the hillside into the water and over to the narrow green island that rose from the quay, like the ridged spine of some slumbering riverbed leviathan. Sovereign's Isle had been the seat of Ossian monarchs for centuries, but no monarch ruled there now. At the entrance of the bridge, standing to either side, were two towering statues, King Farrell the Sound and his queen, Ilidia of Trine. Farrell was holding his hand out towards his wife and looking across at her, as if to direct the viewer's attention that way. Ilidia was bent slightly, arms spread in a gesture that said, "This is yours," for the Promise Bridge had been her gift to the people of the city. "And what will I leave?" Mara thought, as she passed beneath the statues, and a shadow fell on her heart. "Who will remember my name when I'm gone?" The story of the Promise Bridge was well known among the poor folk of Morganholm. Farrell was but a prince when he fell in love with Ilidia, daughter of the High Thane of Trine, who was visiting Farrell's father at the palace. Ilidia had observed on her visit that there was a bridge linking the north side of the river to Sovereign's Isle, but those on the south side had to cross the river by boat. The rich occupied the north bank, living in orderly beauty among the imposing ruins of the Second Empire, while the south bank was chaotic and dangerous, the province of the poor. Ilidia was kind of heart and ever a champion of the weak, so when Farrell asked for her hand in marriage, she agreed on one condition, that he build a bridge to the south, so all might cross to Sovereign's Isle. Farrell was horrified at the idea of common folk tramping past the royal palace in their hordes, but Elidia said it would do him good to be reminded how the meanest of his subjects lived. So Farrell promised her the bridge, and when they were married, he kept that promise. Elidia had become one of Ossia's most beloved queens. "One day," Mara said to herself, "one day they will build a statue to me too, and I will leave something greater than a bridge behind." But she'd become gloomy, and her bravado did little to cheer her. Every day the sands of her life ran thinner, and the window of opportunity narrowed. While the Crodans ruled Ossia, her voice would never be heard, and there was no sign of that changing any time soon. Unless, she thought, unless. A banner had been hung across the bridge, displaying the crests of Prince Otico and Princess Sorrel of Harrow. Thomas and Toven stood to either side, one holding a book, the other a blade. A feverish excitement had gripped the city as the impending celebrations neared. A week's holiday had been declared to welcome their Lord Protector, even whole days of revels beginning on the day of the wedding. It was a level of generosity unheard of under the Crodan regime. They were buying Ossian hearts with a celebration while they put a Crodan in place of their murdered queen and the ember blade in his hand. It was cynical and obvious, and Mara was depressingly certain that it would work. People had short memories, and 30 years was long enough for the complacent to get used to anything. But Mara hadn't forgotten, and she wouldn't celebrate. The day the Emperor's son was welcomed as their Lord Protector would be the day Ossia embraced her own slavery. Across the bridge, Sovereign's Isle was festooned with flags and banners. The plazas were a swarm, and a festival was setting up in King's Park, which would be open to the public for the celebrations. Mummers performed before the gates of the royal palace, and vendors peddled exotic sweetmeats in the shadow of the House of Aspects, the greatest shrine to the old gods in all of Ossia. The Crodans hadn't dared to tear that one down yet, but it was only a matter of time. Mara passed them all with barely a glance, heading across the island to Pastor's Bridge, and thence to the north side of the river. At the top of the hill were the uplanes, where the rich dwelled among the towering edifices of a lost empire. Her business was lower down, in Clockcross, the craft district. There, artists and artisans toiled beneath the horolith, the mysterious ancient timepiece, which had somehow survived the ruin of its makers and still kept perfect time a millennium after it was built. Braden's cooperage was a plain wooden building on a street facing out over the river. Mara paused at the door, gathering herself. "I will not ask," she told herself. "I do not wish to know." Then she pushed the door open and went inside. The workshop was busy and cluttered, stacked with staves and metal hoops, apprentices working at tables in between. A barrel was being toasted by the open window, the interior dancing with firelight thrown by the brazier inside it. The air smelled of warm wood, sweat and sawdust.
"Braden, customer,"
one of the apprentices yelled as he saw her. At the far end of the workshop, a thick-set man with a bushy black beard looked up. He laid aside the hammer he'd been using to knock dents from a hoop and came over, dusting his hands.
"Mara," he said gruffly, with a respectful nod.
"Braden?" A moment of awkwardness. The big cooper was always uneasy at the sight of her these days. It brought his loyalties into conflict.
"This way," he said at last, gesturing towards the back.
She followed him through the workshop and out into a small yard which held a cart, a tiny stable, and a few storage sheds. He unlocked the smallest and opened it, inviting her inside. She stepped into the shed. There, in the gloom, were a dozen barrels standing on end. Each of them was set with a carved crest, two wolves rampant to either side of a spreading tree, the emblem of the Amberline Vineyards. Mara inspected them critically.
"Finest oak from the forests of Trine," Braden said. "Carthanian iron on the hoops. The crests are copied perfectly.
It'd take a master craftsman to spot the difference.
A fine job, Mara agreed, and at such short notice, my heartfelt thanks.
The boys did some, but I finished them on my own. Didn't want them knowing what we were making. Any of this comes back to me, they're not involved.
It won't, Mara assured him. I've told no one. She circled one of the barrels, peering at it as if she could see inside. They're exactly as I asked? He moved over to show her.
Two separate compartments inside. The central compartment is about one-third the volume. That's where you put your wine. There's a bung in the bilge so you can taste it, another in the head for the spigot when you're ready to serve.
He slapped the barrel with his palms on either side.
The other compartment sits against the sides. Two chambers, connected across but sealed off from the central part. That one you can't pour from.
So how do I fill it?
There's a tiny bung behind the amberline crest. He tapped the emblem on the head of the barrel. I've left them loose so you can get to them. You'll need to glue them down when you're done.
So if the first compartment is full of amberline, anyone drinking from this barrel will suspect nothing amiss.
Aye, till it runs out and they realise the barrel is still more than half full. Reckon that'll raise their suspicions right enough.
A question hung at the end of his words. She didn't answer it. He gave her a long look, then asked it out loud.
So what's the game, Mara? Fill the second compartment with water? You buy one barrel of amberline, sell it as three?
What's the game? She thought, studying the barrel. I'm not entirely sure.
But she said nothing. Braden scratched his beard. Not my business, but you're a rich woman. What need you got for ripping off merchants?
You're right, said Mara. It's not your business, and you've been very well paid for your trouble. If that hurt, it didn't show. Mara felt guilty anyway. He was doing her a kindness and didn't deserve to be treated sharply. I appreciate your help, Braden, she told him, and your concern, but I know what I'm doing. Even as she said it, she wondered if that was true. Braden grunted and fell silent. Mara spotted her cue to leave, but something was keeping her here. I won't ask, I won't ask. You didn't tell Danric about this?
Braden tensed at the name. He was uncomfortable around other people's emotions. No doubt he'd hoped to avoid this conversation.
Course not, he said. It's between you and I.
But you feel bad, having to keep it from your oldest friend. I'm sorry I put you in that position. There was no one else I could trust.
Braden shrugged it off. We're friends too, ain't we? What passed between you and Danric don't affect that.
Except that it does, she thought. So I'll ask no further. I won't. Is he well?
She tried to sound nonchalant, but neither of them was fooled. Well enough.
And his family?
He gave her a pitying look. Don't do this to yourself.
Are they also well? She prompted.
Braden let out a heavy sigh. Aye, thriving. Little Jad never stops running. He wants to be a smith like his da. Minda's three now, charming all who see her. Ariala's heavy with their third.
A third?
Mara kept the shock from her face and forced a smile to cover the ache of grief that followed.
I'm happy to hear that, she said. Please pass on my congratulations.
I'll do that, he lied.
I must go. Appointments to keep. Can you deliver the barrels tomorrow?
Tomorrow it is. You take care of yourself, Mara.
You too.
Mara stared listlessly at the up lanes through the carriage window. The skeleton of the old city reared above the great houses, built taller and bolder than they could ever manage now. Great arches of pink stone, some still intact, spanned Victory Way. The crumbled bowl of the mummery held up one windowed wall to the sun, casting shadows across a sandy floor where the greatest actors of the Second Empire once trod. On the battlements of the old wall, outlined by the falling day, stood the lost Colossus, broken off at the shins, its identity never to be known. The works of their ancestors loomed everywhere in Ossia, but in Morgenholm they were inescapable.
Only Caradhis, capital of the Second Empire, was greater. But Caradhis was a cursed and haunted place now, where only the mad or desperate went. How can we ever move on when we don't let ourselves forget the past? She shouldn't have asked after Danric. What foolish urge made her probe old wounds that way? What did it bring but pain? Truth, she told herself. The truth was always worth the consequences. Knowledge was to be faced, never evaded, and she wasn't capable of being willfully ignorant. That was for the weak-minded, the kind who'd toast the arrival of a Croden prince to crush their last hope of freedom. It wasn't in her nature to shy away from the reality of things. Her feelings were always secondary to that. What would it be, this third child of theirs, boy or girl? She thought of Jad with his curly, corn-coloured hair, and Minder with her dimples and plaits. She'd never seen them, but they'd lived in her mind a long time. She indulged herself in fantasy for a while, playing with them in the snow on a winter's day, relishing the sweet hurt of it. Gods, she was tired. Tired of the struggle, tired of the anger and disappointment, tired of battling through the years. She'd been swimming against the current for so long, and she felt her losses keenly today. Perhaps she'd been too hard on that man. She taught only girls, that was the rule, but perhaps if the boy was all he said, she could bend the rules just this once. She didn't want to be so inflexible. At her core were kindness, care, and love. It was the world that had made her tough. Why not, she thought. Teach the boy. You have his name, so Clea will find him easily enough. You can make time for one more, can't you? The carriage rattled round a corner, and as it turned, Mara saw a smartly dressed man in black velvet with a polished oak walking stick and an artificial leg. It was an ingenious contraption of leather and metal and wood, with a hinged locking knee and a flexible heel and ankle, allowing him to walk without a crutch. A Maliard limb. Mara only saw him for a moment, but when she drew back from the window, her face was grim and all kindness had withered in her heart. She didn't teach boys. That was the rule. She'd stick to it. To soften was a betrayal of herself. To flex was weakness. No compromise. Never again. She stared at nothing as the carriage rolled on, her thoughts bitter as acid. Mara's house was on a broad avenue on the edge of the uplanes, set back from the road, with a ruined section of the old wall rising behind it, and the grey peaks of the Cat's Claws in the distance. Another wall, considerably smaller and newer, surrounded the house and its gardens, setting it apart from its neighbours, who claimed similarly grand and spacious territories. The wheels of the carriage crushed rust-coloured leaves into the cobbles as it approached the wrought-iron gate and clattered to a stop. Tied through the bars of the gate was a black handkerchief. Mara gazed at it as Clea climbed down, untied the handkerchief without comment, and put it in her pocket. "So it begins," she thought. "Have Larrier prepare the house," she told Clea. "We will have visitors tonight." 64. They carried Vika into the bedroom on a litter of wooden poles and sackcloth, Harrod in the lead and Garrick behind. Ruck howled from down the corridor, where she'd been locked in another room by Grubb and Aaron. Mara closed the door on the racket, but Ruck howled nonetheless.
"Gentle now, gentle," Garrick murmured as they lifted her from the litter onto a bed finer than they'd seen for months. He had no need to. Harrod was a careful and precise man, and he treated her like porcelain.
"Let me examine the wound," said Mara, as soon as Vika was safely on the bed. "Garrick, help me undress her."
"I should return to Milady," Harrod said quickly, alarmed by the prospect of nudity.
He gave Mara a stiff bow and left the room as fast as he decently could.
"How long?" Mara asked as they unfastened her blouse.
13 days. She's been out since the arrow hit."
13 days? Mara said in amazement.
"Aye," he said grimly.
13 days since they'd left Rakan Bay in the storm. They'd made it upriver as far as Jerlo, where they caught the first passenger ship to Westport, arriving just in time to catch another heading to Morganholm. That one went at a leisurely pace with several stops on the way, delivering them to Morganholm a day before the cargo promised by Katat Az was due. Garrick didn't mind. He was glad they'd got here at all. The Iron Hand was swift, and they'd been looking over their shoulders every moment they'd been in port. They pulled off Vika's shirt. They'd taken out the arrow on Jadril's boat. Garrick had some experience treating battle injuries, and afterwards washed the paint from her face and removed all signs of her faith. Transporting an injured woman was suspicious enough. Were it known she was a druidess, the Crodans would surely have found them. Lying there, eyes closed and injured, she was no longer the imposing figure who'd first emerged from the darkness on a windy mountainside. Garrick thought it wrong to see her so diminished. The wound in her shoulder was a puckered red circle, edged with putrid black tendrils that extended some way under her skin. Mara made a noise of faint disappointment as she saw it. She examined the wound closely, stretching and prodding it, sniffing the clear, rancid fluid that wept out. It was an arrow?
A Dreadknight's arrow. There was some kind of poison on it, we think.
Help me lift her. They half turned her so Mara could see the exit wound. She's not woken at all? He shook his head.
We pour milk and honey into her mouth and she swallows it. She rants in her delirium, sometimes in Ossian and sometimes in another tongue.
He felt a coldness settle on his heart.
She speaks of Kar Vishnak, the citadel of chains, and converses with the torments.
Mara hmmed at that and said no more. Garrick stepped back while she finished her examination, taking a moment to look around the room. Silver candelabra pressed back the dark, spilling soft light across embroidered pillows and sumptuous drapes newly hung in advance of the winter. There were thick rugs from Caragua in the far west, and the furniture was crafted with a delicacy and elegance rarely seen in common houses. In his younger days he'd often visited places like this, but decades on the run had hardened him, and he distrusted luxury now. "The prognosis is not encouraging," said Mara at last. "See these black tendrils around the wound? Her blood has turned bad, and it will only get worse. The rot is too close to her heart to cut out. By all means, send for an apothecary, but I have studied medicine and—"
"I'd be a fool to doubt your knowledge, but you haven't heard all of it. 5 days ago the corruption was all over her chest and back."
"That's impossible."
"I saw it with my own eyes. That arrow would have killed any one of us, but she has fought the poison back and she is healing."
Mara gave him a skeptical look. Ruck was calming down at last in the other room, her howls fading to sorry whimpers.
"I swear it, Mara. She's a druidess."
"Oh, that explains it then," said Mara sarcastically. "I expect the aspects themselves are looking after her."
"Scoff if you will. If you'd seen what I have, you'd sing a different tune. None of us would be here if not for her."
"I thought better of you," she said with undisguised scorn. "Taken in by parlour tricks and imaginary gods."
"There's more in this world than can be measured by your experiments. You say it's impossible that she will heal. I say you've always used that word too readily."
Mara sniffed, dismissing his observation. She wasn't one to take criticism or advice from her intellectual inferiors. "Be that as it may, there is little that can be done for her. I will have Laria change her dressings and feed her. She will die or she will not."
"She will not die," said Garrick. "I'll tend her myself."
Mara gave him a strange look. "As you wish." Once they'd made Vika comfortable, they left her to rest and went to Mara's study. There she poured them glasses of rich red Carthanian wine, and went to stand by the tall arched windows, looking down onto the gardens, where the others wandered in the moonlight, stretching their legs after so long aboard ship.
"You've lost many," she said, "and gained others." Garrick sipped his wine, and the exquisite taste sent guilty pleasure flooding through him.
"We've travelled a hard road," he said.
"How are they?"
"The Sard and the Harish, I don't know. We just needed their cart. We can't trust them, but they know too much to send them away."
"Keep them close, but not too close."
"It's only for a short while. Perhaps you can persuade them to accept your gracious hospitality."
"I'll see what I can manage," she said wryly.
"Fenn wavered, but I think she'll stay. Helps that there's some her own age with us. She's tough, but she's young, and not as grown up as she thinks. I wouldn't trust the Skarl as far as I could throw him, but he's in too deep to dislodge, and the boy won't let him go anyway."
"Which boy?"
"Aaron."
"Who is he?" Garrick's pause was a beat too long.
"Just a boy."
"Can we trust him?"
"As much as we can trust anyone."
"How reassuring. And Keel?"
"Keel's falling apart. After what he saw in Skavengard, and now his family..." He sighed. "He's not faring well."
"What do you intend to do about that?"
"Nothing I can do. He'll stand firm till Hammerholt. That's all I need."
He let his gaze roam the study. It was cosy and dim, lit by wall lamps, with Mara's desk in the brightest spot. An angular iron candelabrum of Erdish design, from the days when humans were slaves in this land, stood in one corner. Shadows gathered between laden bookshelves and at the feet of pedestals that held stuffed birds and the skulls of foreign animals. An architectural plan was framed on the wall, Mara's work, describing a building that only existed in her mind. He took another mouthful of wine. Gods, it was good. Maybe he'd have another after this. What harm in a bit of pleasure, after all? He took little enough of it.
"You got my letter?" he asked.
"The barrels are coming tomorrow," said Mara. "The cart is already here, an exact copy of the kind the Master Vintner uses, with the requisite alterations. I had a friend make the barrels. The cart was built by an artisan on the other side of the city."
"Never let the right hand know what the left hand is doing," Garrick said.
"I find it's usually wise. Speaking of which, how do you plan to switch your cart with the Master Vintner's?"
"Willem the Smiler will handle it."
"Ah," she said, communicating boundless disdain in a single syllable.
"Question his motives, if you will, but he's yet to let me down."
"He doesn't fight the Crodans because he believes in Ossia. He fights for the love of chaos and discord."
"Chaos and discord are what we seek, are they not?"
Mara conceded him the point with a flick of her wrist and an irate moo.
"And what of Yarin?"
Mara sipped her wine and turned away from the window. "There we have a problem. Yarin has disappeared." Garrick's grip tightened on his glass.
"What happened?"
"The Crodans moved into the ghetto a week ago and began clearing everybody out. They packed the Sards onto trains of prison carts going east. Yarin was taken with them." Garrick felt a hot ball of rage growing in his belly. Not now, not when they were so close. Why couldn't the Crodans have waited one more week? Why did the Aspects always conspire to foil him?
"We need those plans," he barked angrily.
"Yarin would be touched by your concern," said Mara sarcastically. "However, there is hope yet. Before he was taken, he found the information we need and stashed it in a secret location in the ghetto. I can only presume it is still there."
"Then we must go and get it."
"Easier said than done. The Crodans have sealed it off to keep looters out while they search for hidden Sards. There are patrols day and night."
"We'll risk it. We have no chance without those plans."
"Agreed." Garrick drained his glass.
"Where did the Sards go?"
"I don't know. Nobody knows."
More clearances, more sards taken east. The Crodans were up to something, but he was God's damned if he knew what, and he had no time to investigate. He couldn't afford any distractions. An image of Yarin appeared in his mind, that wily old sard with his seamed face and gnarled hands, his green eyes paled by the years. He'd been their contact among the landless, many of whom were as eager as Garrick to see the Crodans driven from Ossia. Garrick never knew how extensive Yarin's network was, whether he was the mastermind or the agent of some hidden operator, but he'd been a valuable ally. Garrick regretted the loss of a useful resource, but no more than that. They hadn't been close, and it was hard to care about anything now beyond what had to be done.
"What's going into the barrels?" she asked.
The question caught him off guard. He sensed her watching him keenly and avoided her gaze. He poured himself more wine instead.
"Amberline," he said, "and water. We'll swap a dozen barrels that are only one-third full of wine for a dozen full ones. 8 barrels profit. That's Willem's payment for his services."
"I could have just paid him the money and saved myself the considerable trouble of having them made, not to mention the risk."
"Never let the right hand know what the left hand is doing," said Garrick, raising a newly full glass to her.
"I see," she said. "And this mysterious cargo arriving on a Zulan ship that I'm to pay for?"
"That's the Amberline to go in the casks."
30 falcons for a few barrels of Amberline?
"Only the best for the prince, and at such short notice the price was high."
Mara didn't believe him for an instant.
"What an incredibly convoluted way of doing something very simple," she observed. "Give me my due. I play castles a lot. I see you moving your pieces into place for the end game. What do you really intend?"
Garrick swigged his wine.
"Shouldn't have picked such a smart right hand," he grumbled.
"I'm no one's right hand, Garrick, and I won't be kept in the dark. Not if you want that shipment paid for." Garrick stewed on that for a moment. She had him, it seemed. But why shouldn't he tell her? If there was any among them who might see things his way, it was Mara. She prized sense over sentiment and understood the need for sacrifice. Besides, it would be a waste of time trying to convince her that ignorance was for her own good. He never knew anyone so loath of ignorance as she.
"I will tell you, on your oath of secrecy," he said. "The others wouldn't understand."
"I'll make no such oath, but I'll not tell the others unless what you propose forces me to." He had to be content with that, so he told her his plan, staring into his glass as he did so, his face mirrored red in the wine. When he'd finished, he looked up and was alarmed to see tears in her eyes, this woman who wasn't given to crying.
"This is no time for weakness, Mara," he warned quickly. "It has to be this way. You see that, don't you?"
A smile broke over her face at his foolishness, her eyes creasing, dislodging tears. She wiped them away.
"You never could read hearts, Garrick. I am not sad or horrified. I weep because you give me hope of a day when my pupils will be considered the equal of men, and Ossia is ruled by Ossian laws again. I knew you were a man of conviction, Garrick, but I did not realize how far you would go."